B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. Democratic voters, shepherded by the party's leadership and the corporate media, have basically decided that Donald Trump is going to get a second term. With a major sweep in the primaries held on Tuesday, Joe Biden is in a very strong position to secure the nomination. And the hopes of Bernie Sanders and his supporters are fading. Now, I want to be clear, it's mathematically possible for Bernie Sanders to still pull this out. But the trends are pretty clear. And what we have seen in the last couple of weeks is stunning. It leaves many Sanders supporters bewildered, trying to figure out what happened. Because this reversal of fortunes, where Biden was politically dead, Sanders was on the ascent. And after the party leadership got that memo from Mike Bloomberg and his staff, and after the victory in the Nevada caucuses, it's very clear that decisions were made to stop Bernie Sanders. And those decisions have had a stunning impact in a very short period of time. And it was really quite depressing to watch the returns come in. I had hoped that the polls about Michigan would be proven wrong. But Biden's sweep was even bigger than those polls predicted. And Washington State, that Sanders won in a landslide against Clinton 4 years ago, is still too close to call. It's a virtual tie. And what this tells us, when you combine the voter behavior, what they tell the exit poll questioners, and that is, they essentially support Bernie's policies, but they don't believe he can win. And why they believe that Joe Biden, who is stumbling and bumbling, carrying all that political baggage, why they believe he can beat Trump and Sanders can't, continues to baffle me. Now, I know that most people don't have as much information as you and I do. They don't bother. But to just take the word of MSNBC and CNN and say, well, if we're going to defeat Trump, we all have to rally around this wounded Joe Biden, I just find it inexplicable. And it lays the groundwork. Absent any big shift, Trump could lose. But I don't think Biden will beat him. Trump will lose to coronavirus, to a worldwide recession. But I don't think he will be beaten by a Democratic campaign led by Joe Biden. So Bernie Sanders kept to himself last night. He was hunkered down at his home in Burlington, Vermont. And the media made a big deal that he didn't come out and speak. But he did appear this morning. And you'll notice from his first phrase that Bernie Sanders has pivoted to, I think, preparing himself and his supporters for the likely loss to Joe Biden. And so his opening statement, as you'll hear, is that his top priority is to beat Trump.
Last night, obviously, was not a good night for our campaign from a delegate point of view. We lost in the largest state up for grabs yesterday, the state of Michigan. We lost in Mississippi, Missouri, and Idaho. I very much look forward to the debate in Arizona with my friend Joe Biden. And let me be very frank as to the questions that I will be asking Joe. Joe, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of the United States of America being the only major country on earth where health care is not a human right? Are you really going to veto a Medicare for All bill if it is passed in Congress. Joe, how are you going to respond to the scientists who tell us we have 7 or 8 years remaining to transform our energy system before irreparable harm takes place to this planet because of the ravages of climate change? Donald Trump must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen. On Sunday night, in the first one-on-one debate of this campaign, the American people will have the opportunity to see which candidate is best positioned to accomplish that goal.
Now, this is a different clip than the one I thought I was going to play. And his comment about defeating Trump is placed at the end. But he actually
2014,
bookended...
Russia sends troops into...
But he actually bookended his remarks with that similar statement that his top priority is to beat Trump. And it's possible that in the Sunday debate that Sanders will pull his punches and contrast himself with Joe Biden, but not go for the jugular. And it's fair to say that Bernie doesn't go for the jugular and has gone light on Joe Biden in the previous debates. So the questions that he posited, I'm sure he will try to bring them up. It's a different format. They're not standing at a podium. They're sitting in chairs. The moderators apparently will ask some of the questions, but they were planning to have audience questions, but because of the coronavirus shutdowns on public gatherings, it's possible that those will be videotaped questions coming in. And so as we look at this, it is a real setback for progressives and for those of us who thought that there was some prospect that Sanders could prevail in this complex primary race and end up as the nominee running against Donald Trump. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said there's no sugarcoating it. Tonight's a tough night. Sanders was on pace to win 0 counties in Missouri and in Mississippi, which is not unexpected. He lost Idaho, where he won in 2016. As I mentioned, Washington State is still too close to call. Last I checked, Sanders had a lead of about 1,000 votes statewide. In Missouri, Sanders was trailing in every single county in a state where he won dozens of counties in 2016. And the real problem here is two factors. Number one, white boomers of my age are turning out in record numbers, and they appear all to be voting for Joe Biden. I will not excuse you, boomers, for this incredible blunder. And the other big disappointment is that young voters are not turning out, even in the numbers that they did in 2016. I can't explain this. They show up at his rallies. I see them online. And I don't know why so many young voters are just sitting this one out. Now, what we saw in California, in Nevada, was this big age divide where Sanders was dominating the electorate under age 50. But that has melted away. So, here's an analysis from Mississippi. Voters under 45 years old were 41% of the electorate in 2016, but only accounted for 32% in 2020. Now, that is a huge drop, and that's not just the voters from 18 to 29. The biggest jump came among 65 or older. 31% of the electorate, up from only 22% 4 years ago. So I don't know how many of these disaffected voters listen to this podcast, but I do invite you to reach out to me and explain. If you didn't vote in your primary this year, what motivated that? Was it just you being fed up? Or was there some strategic decision that you made that isn't apparent to me? So last night, because Political rallies for both Biden and Sanders had been canceled in Ohio. Joe Biden went to Philadelphia, and he spoke before a group of his own campaign staff. And they, of course, applauded him at appropriate moments. But I have to say that Joe Biden was measured. He was low-key. He had a few, you know, minor issues with his speech, but they were the equivalent of loose dentures in my hearing of it. And he used a teleprompter. He didn't appear to deviate from the script that was on the screen before him. But his message was one of restoration. The idea that we can put back what Condoleezza Rice used to refer to as the status quo ante, the way things were before. And Biden appears to be appealing to nostalgia for the Obama administration. And this is a cul-de-sac, because it does appeal to some people who were part of the Obama coalition, people who have, rosy view of the Obama administration, because they did okay when Barack was president. But there are millions of Americans who didn't. They never recovered from 2008. They didn't recover from the job losses in manufacturing in the Midwest. The Obama administration opened the door for the election of Trump. These people are oblivious. They want to repeat the same errors of 2016, compounded by the idea that you can put Humpty Dumpty back up on that wall. But it's selling to a majority of the voters who showed up yesterday. Now, I want to credit Paul Waldman. As I've mentioned, he writes op-eds for The Washington Post. And, 12 years ago or so, he was a weekly contributor to my syndicated radio show. He would call in when he worked at Media Matters, and we would discuss the media spin from Fox and other outlets that was supporting final few days of the Bush administration. And I have my issues with Waldman. He's a kind of moderate establishment Democrat. But in his column today, which I've linked to in the show file for this podcast, the headline reads, "Age-related mental decline is a real issue for both Biden and Trump." Now, I think that is a fair way to wade into the commentary that is off-limits today if you're part of the Democratic machinery, and that includes the media pundits who refuse to acknowledge the decline of Joe Biden's cognitive abilities. And last night I was watching CNN, and the panel tiptoed around it. I think at one point Van Jones made a comment about how, you know, Biden is prone to gaffes. But nobody there would mention what is obvious to all of us who are unbiased and who are not in denial about Joe Biden. So Waldman writes that Trump has decided to build his campaign on the accusation that Biden is suffering a mental decline that makes him unfit for office. Unlike many of the claims Trump makes, this one is not completely without evidence. Now, that is a very measured statement, right? He says it's not completely without evidence. So he's trying not to offend his Democratic readers. And he alarms them with Trump and his allies are mounting a comprehensive, coordinated effort to paint Biden as senile. And they go through the tweets that you're probably familiar with. It cites that Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, Brit Hume, Rudy Giuliani, all have made recent comments about alleged senility or signs of dementia on the part of Joe Biden. And Waldman writes, of course, coming from Trump and his allies, this is utterly bonkers. The president regularly gives remarks full of bizarre digressions, puzzling illogic, garbled words, and slurred speech. He says his father was born in Germany, actually it was New York, says oranges when he means origins, thinks windmills cause cancer, and appears to believe that stealth planes are literally invisible to the naked eye. And Waldman continues, just as Trump accuses his opponents of being corrupt to counter the weighty evidence of his own corruption, the attack on Biden's mental state is part of an attempt to distract people from the fact that Trump himself is temperamentally, intellectually, and morally unfit to manage a 7-Eleven, let alone the country. He doesn't use the word projection, but that's what he's talking about. And then he says, I'm not saying that discussion of Biden's mental acuity should be off limits. Good for you, Paul. Then he says we shouldn't forget that some on the left, including Bernie Sanders supporters, have aggressively promoted the idea that Biden is experiencing cognitive decline. It's because we're alarmed. Because the idiot Democratic electorate is falling in line to put up a guy who's going to lose big time with defects, including these infirmities, that are obvious to us at the very time that he is being forced upon us or foisted on us. One more bite from Waldman. If Biden is the nominee, we'll have two candidates in their 70s, neither one of whom seems quite as sharp as they were in earlier days. You can see it with Biden on the stump every day, and you can see it by comparing the Trump of today to the one you'll find in old interviews, in which he's far more articulate and able to see a thought through from beginning to end. And now we go into this bubble zone, where the bubble that was set up to protect Joe Biden from any criticism over his son's role on the board of Burisma, over the whole Ukraine investigation, over his role in the firing of the Ukrainian chief prosecutor, all of that was set aside and we were told they did nothing wrong. And as I frequently said, the actions of the Bidens were as perfect as Trump claims his phone call to Zelensky was. And Trump's lingering guilt about that showed up in a comment that he made at the CDC last week, where he's talking about how coronavirus test kits are perfect, just like his letter, he was talking about the transcript, of the phone call with Zelensky. Well, the Ukraine thing is not going to go away. But there has been an abrupt shift on the part of Ron Johnson, the chair of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee. He was going to call a Ukrainian official connected to Burisma, a guy named Andriy Telezhenko, to testify. And now Ron Johnson, who chairs the committee, Republican from Wisconsin, says out of an abundance of caution and to allow time for senators to receive additional briefings, that he would postpone this. And this was driven by Michigan Democrat Senator Gary Peters, who called for additional intelligence and law enforcement briefings on whether pursuing investigations of the Bidens and Burisma would assist the ongoing Russian campaign to interfere in our elections this year. Oh, boy. You know, they just keep shoveling that bullshit at us. And because of the huge wave and the giant margins that Biden has run up, and they are increasing from one week to the next, it will make it virtually impossible. It's going to drown out any concerns about the integrity of these primary elections. And I'm not letting go. I have linked to the website of a man named Theodore Macedo Soares. He has been monitoring exit polls since 2008. And he looks at Massachusetts. Disparities greatly exceeded the margin of error. South Carolina. Biden's vote count exhibited the largest disparity from his exit poll projection. California. The disparity between the exit polls and the tally to date appears to have cut Bernie Sanders' lead by half. Even his home state of Vermont, the exit poll and vote count for Sanders and Biden had disparities of 10.8%. And in Texas, Biden lost in the computer counts by 4.5%. So, these are serious defects. and they will never really be deeply investigated, at least not by mainstream or government officials, because they'll say, who cares? Bernie lost, and this could not make the difference. Meanwhile, an op-ed at The Guardian today by a couple of election activists argues for ranked choice voting in the presidential primaries. We discussed this earlier this year in a podcast with Adam Eichen, who is a young activist. Eichen is affiliated with Professor Larry Lessig, and he has advanced the proposal to use ranked choice voting in the presidential primaries. And it could have changed things quite a bit this year as the wave of support shifted so dramatically. And we still have questions about whether that shift was orchestrated. One of the things I take issue with in this op-ed is that they say, we saw what happened in 2018 in the San Francisco mayoral race. Two progressive candidates, Mark Leno and Jane Kim, actually campaigned together to fight for shared values as they reached out to voters in a ranked choice election. Now, there is the benefit that in ranked choice voting, you don't get profit from attacking your opponent because they could be, their supporters could be your second choice voters, right? But the problem here in San Francisco was that Mark Leno and Jane Kim split the progressive vote, allowing the pro-corporate establishment candidate, London Breed, to win the race. On Capitol Hill, there's been a wrangling in the confirmation hearings of a guy named James Trey Traynor. He's from Texas, and he's been appointed by Trump to the Federal Elections Commission. And his nomination has been languishing. The committee has finally decided to look at it. I'm not sure what happened in the last year and a half. But Amy Klobuchar, who everybody knows now, is challenging this guy Traynor because he doesn't believe in basic campaign finance laws, political spending limits, and because he was deeply allied with the guru of redistricting, of gerrymandering, Tom Hoefler. And Hoefler, we have profiled his work in podcast interviews with David Daley. So it looks like the Senate is not going to move forward to confirm this guy. Even Republicans seem very concerned about him. But the bottom line is that the Federal Elections Commission hasn't met since last August. They don't have enough members for a quorum. And the Democratic seat that's open has been unfilled for over 1,100 days. And this is the commission that should evaluate complaints about fundraising, about, misleading or deceitful campaign commercials. But they are conveniently inoperative during another campaign cycle this year. And just a quick note from here in California, Ann Revell, who is the previous chair, a Democrat who served on the FEC, won a primary election for a state Senate seat here in California. She's based in San Jose and will run against another Democratic opponent in the fall. Kamala Harris is complaining, accurately, about the coverage that she received from the media when she ran for president last year. And she talks about some clear episodes of bias where reporters assigned to cover her did not understand. For example, the zeitgeist at Howard University. And I don't quibble with the complaints that Harris offers. But she's only concerned about herself. And she doesn't mention the blatant mistreatment by the media of Bernie Sanders and, more recently, Tulsi Gabbard. And I think that says a lot about who Kamala Harris really is. I don't believe she had to drop out of the presidential campaign because of biased coverage. It was because she was exposed as a poser of a progressive. And it was Tulsi Gabbard who did the exposure. Over at the New York Times, opinionator Ross Douthat offers two narratives or two analyses of why Bernie Sanders is suffering in these primaries and Joe Biden is on the rise. And his pundit description says that, you know, the field consolidated suddenly and surprisingly around a resurgent Biden, and Sanders hadn't prepared adequately for that possibility and wasn't quick enough to pivot in response. That's a fair criticism. Then he goes on to say that after his victory in Nevada, that instead of reaching out to Democrats who appeared uncomfortable with Sanders, those days were spent in either an admirably principled or insanely truculent argument about how the Cuban communist issues related to Bernie. And this really makes me angry, because that was a trap. It was an ambush conducted by Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes, who raised an irrelevant question about the way Sanders commented on Cuba in the 1970s and 1980s. So I don't agree with Douthat there. But then he says his second theory is that the coronavirus has scared the shit out of so many Americans that it has led them to a flight to safety. And the arms of Joe Biden caressing the shoulders of a stranger from behind, that's what people see as safety? When Bernie Sanders is the one who talks about shaking up the healthcare system in this country to make it more democratic, to make sure that everybody is covered. And how can the people of Michigan ignore that and say that Joe Biden is the guy who can deal with this pandemic? You can tell I am a befuddled guy today. My friend Norman Solomon has a piece over at Common Dreams, and he's not ducking the reality. He says that the chances of Bernie winning the nomination have sharply diminished, but it's still possible. And he says, no matter what, movements for basic social change and democracy will vitally persist, with long-term struggles to wrest power out of the hands of oligarchs and their functionaries is up to us. He also notes that dominant media have routinely slanted coverage to make Sanders look bad, often bypassing context and skewing facts. He references the smear last week about Bernie as mayor of Burlington trying to set up a sister city relationship with a Soviet town. He says corporate media and corporate Democrats want the Bernie 2020 campaign and the grassroots energy behind it to melt away. But he says that's not going to happen. And a great piece, a deep dive over at consortiumnews.com by Jonathan Cook, who takes a kind of big picture, high altitude view of this race in the United States. Biden's campaign is a reminder that power is indivisible. Trump or Biden for president, it doesn't matter to the power establishment. An egomaniacal man-child, Trump, representing the billionaires, or an elder suffering rapid neurological degeneration, Biden, representing the billionaires, are equally useful to power. A woman will do, too, or a person of color. The establishment is no longer worried about who stands on stage, so long as that person is not a Bernie Sanders in the U.S. or a Jeremy Corbyn in the U.K. And he goes on to discuss the powerful, virulent, and inaccurate Bernie Bros tag that was effective in depicting Sanders and his supporters as out of control, angry, attacking people on Twitter. What else do you do on Twitter? And the role of the DNC in this remarkable transition of just the last couple of weeks. He writes, because power prefers darkness, the DNC is doing its best to exercise the power behind the scenes out of sight, at least unseen by those who still rely on the mainstream corporate media, which is also part of the power establishment. I've linked to Cook's piece. It's in the show file for today's podcast, and it is a recommended read. Ryan Grimm at The Intercept gets it right, too, because he echoes my scenario that it was the 60 Minutes interview that began the decline of Bernie Sanders. It was a trap set up by Anderson Cooper, and it diverted the conversation for a week and a half away from current foreign policy issues of great import to this distraction about whether the red baiting of Sanders was accurate or not. So I think Ryan Grimm has a good analysis of how we got to this ugly spot where we are today. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Suzanne Bowen, Aidan McAleer, Faith Peoples, and Benny Alto. They each chip in $5 to $20 a month to support my ranting and raving. And you can do it too. All you have to do is stop by peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll be taken to the sign-up page, and it just takes a minute or two to set up a PayPal link and choose the level of support that fits your budget. And if you're allergic to PayPal, yo comprendo, you can address your correspondence to my P.O. Box, number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. On to other news today, an alarming decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, injecting itself into the issues that have been decided by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco, which declared unconstitutional the Trump administration remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers. What is truly alarming is that the justices have decided to overrule the lower court and allow this policy to remain in effect, and eventually they'll get around to examining it and issuing a formal ruling, a decision. And only one justice dissented. From this report in the Washington Post, the lone dissenter was Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And this is so infuriating because on the face of it, the asylum policy violates the Constitution, it violates precedent, and it intentionally puts people in harm's way who are fleeing to the United States to avoid various harms. The Court of Appeals wrote that there are uncontradicted evidence shows that there is extreme danger to asylum seekers who are returned to Mexico. But 8 of the 9 robe wearers on the U.S. Supreme Court said, that doesn't matter. Just let it stand and we'll get around to ruling on it. Maybe some people will die in the meantime, but, you know, they're not Americans, so that's not our problem. I want to recommend a piece by my friend Pepe Escobar appearing today at consortiumnews.com. All week, as the stock market has been on a roller coaster, mostly going down, it's down again today, Trump has tried to blame it on the oil dust-up between Russia and Saudi Arabia. But Pepe's report starts in Vienna last Friday when a meeting of OPEC melted down in what he called a game-changing plot twist. And he says that this was driven by Moscow, who saw a perfect window of opportunity to target the U.S. shale industry and apparently to hurt the Saudis at the same time. Shares of some of these U.S. producers plunged as much as half on Black Monday. They simply cannot survive with a barrel of oil costing in the $30 range. A $30 barrel of oil has to be seen as a precious gift or stimulus package for a global economy in turmoil. And this is what Russia made possible. And apparently, Russia's National Wealth Fund has made it clear they have enough reserves to cover a budget deficit from 6 to 10 years, even with oil at $25 a barrel. Now, this puts the U.S. producers, who have high costs for fracking and the processing of the cruder crude oil that comes from the shale fields. And what Pepe says is, despite what Trump has asserted, the post-Vienna essentially has little to do with a Russia-Saudi trade war. The Russia Energy Ministry is phlegmatic, he said. Moving on, nothing to see here. Riyadh has been emitting signs that the OPEC deal may be back in the cards in the near future. The CIA is fuming, says Pepe, because of the shuffle there and the crackdown by Mohammed bin Salman on his family members, who he accuses of trying to plot for a coup to prevent him from becoming king. So I think this is a really different analysis, fascinating. I've reached out to Pepe to ask him for an interview in the near future, and I hope we can connect and I can bring that to you soon. Harvey Weinstein will die in prison. He was sentenced in a Manhattan courtroom today to 23 years in prison for raping one woman and sexually assaulting another. And at the age of 67, that is likely a life sentence. Interesting developments going all the way back to 1988, when Pan Am Flight 103 was shot down over Lockerbie, Scotland. It killed all aboard and 11 people on the ground. And a trial was held much later, and a Libyan man named Megrahi was convicted. And the leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, later paid reparations to the family members of victims. But I've always suspected that this was a wrongful conviction. I don't pretend to know who was responsible for the shootdown, but the claim that Megrahi had put explosives into a boombox and carried it on the, or, you know, had it placed on the flight, never made sense to me. So get this. Survivors, family members, and family members of the convicted Megrahi have joined forces and filed an appeal of that conviction. This could get interesting. And finally today, coverage of the coronavirus outbreak is difficult for a one-man band like me. And so you can't expect that I'm going to be able to cover this global pandemic. But it has been finally declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. That's bad for the people who bought the pandemic bonds that come due, I think, in July. So they are going to lose their investment there. But that does provide funding for nations that do not have the resources to deal with a crisis of this sort. I also want to mention that in my coverage earlier this week of the Trump photo op at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta last week, I inaccurately said that Anthony Fauci was standing next to Trump and did nothing to intervene as Trump lied. I was wrong about that. It was actually Alex Azar, who is Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary. Fauci himself was on Capitol Hill today telling what he believes to be the truth. The bottom line, it's going to get worse. We recommend that there not be large crowds. If that means not having any people in the audience as the NBA plays, and what about the March Madness tournaments? It does appear that many of those will be played without any fans in attendance. Latest talk of fiscal interventions is to extend the tax filing deadline beyond April 15th. Well, that doesn't do much for most people. And I'm just in the process of putting my tax materials together for the tax preparer right now. I'm going to make that April 15th deadline, whether they extend it or not. And the news from Italy, the case count continues to climb. More than 2,000 increase from day to day. There are now 12,460 identified individuals with coronavirus. More than 800 people have been killed there. The caseload here in the U.S. has crossed the 1,000 mark. And the other day I shared an email that came from our friend Jerry Frazia, who lives at Lake Como in northern Italy. And he said that in a report about his observations last Sunday, well, things have changed a little bit. And he mentions that his wife Cheeky and I, he said, got a tickle from my sharing of his previous report. And he said, I played that for Cheeky just as I was preparing to ride my bike through the main shop area of Bellagio. And he writes, she is more freaked out about all of this than I am. But I'm getting there, he says, arguing that I'm not taking it seriously enough and giving me hell for riding through the shop area to begin with. I said to her, I have to go now. I'm a reporter. Well, Jerry, we're promoting you to correspondent because you've given us great reports. He says when he went around Bellagio, the day began with the announcement of severe new restrictions. I tried to read them in Italian but gave up. I wasn't sure if with these restrictions we would be able to open our gallery or not. The restrictions seem to allow bars and restaurants to open, but they have to close by 6 p.m. Supermarkets are closed on weekends to prevent crowding. Now, he says, you'll recall my last observations took place on a Sunday, which is a day when people from Milan and Como flood Bellagio. So it was not surprising to see pockets of people here and there. Yesterday, however, was different. Everything, all shops were closed. The contrast to what would be a normal spring day was starkly evident. There were a few people walking about. Whenever I would pass these people, we would look searchingly into each other's eyes. The looks were of concern, an awareness perhaps that we are living through an historical moment. The looks were also of fear, as if we were saying to each other, do you feel it too? What is happening? Well, that's our correspondent, Jerry Frazia. We look forward to his next dispatch. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.